My name is Jacob Rinderknecht. I've met many of you. I'm really glad to be back in the village again after about 11 years away. So it's great to be up here on teaching staff and hanging out and getting to know you all. This is the third session of a three-session engagement with metaphor and with cognitive linguistics and theology and dialogue and such. We're going to, recognizing though that not everybody has spent here all week, what we're going to do today is I'm going to do a sort of review of what I'm talking about when I talk about metaphor. Then I'm going to look at ecumenism, specifically the Lutheran Catholic dialogue, but also more broadly how Christians talk to each other as a way of talking about what happens when we have these conversations across major differences. We're going to take a break because we are embodied creatures who might need, a bathroom or a cup of coffee or both. Then when we come back, we're going to look at politics and one theory from a linguist by the name of George Lakoff about what's going on when conservatives and liberals are fighting about government often, which is not a perfect theory, but it is, I think, illuminative. And then we're going to end by talking together about where there are major disagreements in our world, in our community, and maybe start to do some thinking about what those disagreements might be about. Because one of the theses of today's conversation is oftentimes deep and ongoing disagreements are not about the thing that we say they're about. The thing that we say they're about is what we can call an epiphenomenon or a sort of secondary layer that emerges out of a disagreement. Because oftentimes, human beings are of goodwill, can often sit down and dialogue about something, right? We find that we're, generally okay at coming to an agreement about what things are and what's going on and whatever. But when we find a position that where we just cannot even agree on first principles, right? We are absolutely convinced that the other person's just crazy. How could they possibly see that this thing is going on? One of the things I'm going to suggest today is that those are often going to be places where the disagreement's actually somewhere else. And that disagreement, that different difference in viewing the world is producing a structure whereby people are actually seeing different things. And that is often what leads to these disagreements. So that's where we're going to go today. So, the theory of cognitive mapping is a teaching tool. Cognitive mapping has to do with, it arises out of a confluence of cognitional scientists on the one hand and linguists on the other hand. Over the course of the 80s and the 90s into the 2000s, trying to ask what we're doing when we think, which we call metacognition, right? Thinking about thinking. The linguists came at it by going around the world and looking at lots of different languages and trying to see if there were, in fact, human universals in language. Turns out there are some human universals, but a lot fewer than we thought. Things that we thought were human universals, like time, location, color, are more varied if you look at languages that are farther apart from each other than we would expect. So in some languages, particularly East Asian languages, the time is conceived of with the past in front of us. In most of the languages that most of us are familiar with, the past is behind us, right? If I say something like, he has a great future behind him, you're going to assume I'm making a joke,
yeah.
Or I'm playing with language in order to make some kind of complicated point, right? That's not a normal, but we'd say he has a great future ahead of him because we conceive of time in terms of the metaphor of journey, right? I walked up to Heart Lake with some friends yesterday. You can imagine the journey up to Heart Lake as a journey towards a future, right? Because as we go along in time, we're going forward. We're seeing new things. We're engaging with new things. In languages where the metaphor is reversed, the reason that the past is in front of you is because the past is known. And it's a sight-based metaphor rather than a travel-based metaphor. And so my past, I can remember standing in this room 17 years ago wearing clay spattered coveralls and arguing with people at a community meeting about something, right? Because that is a thing that has already happened. It's present in my memory and I can see it, as opposed to what will happen when I go down the road in a week back to San Antonio to teach classes. I have an idea of what it might be like, but I haven't seen it yet, right? It's, the future is still unknown. We also talked on Monday about how most of the languages that we're familiar with are ego-centered in their structure. So if I want to say something like, so you ask me how to get to the village store, and I'll say, go out the front of Quinity and turn left, about 100 feet. And 100 feet down the road, turn right, go up those little stairs. It's right there. There are languages, however, that are geocentered, in which to give those same directions, you'd have to say, go out of the village heading north, out of the Quinity heading north, turn west for 100 feet, and then turn north again, go up the stairs, and you'll be right there. And some of those languages, the way you say, how are you, is to say, what direction are you facing? So they're very, and people end up carrying these 64-point compasses around in their heads all the time. Because even if you want to say to somebody at dinner, could you hand me the peas or the water, you have to say, could you please move the water in a north by northeasterly direction? Because all directions are geocentered in some of these languages. Color, as we said, is another one that's less than universal. Although color is really interesting because there are universals to color that have to do with human biology. Humans in general have the same kinds of rods and cones in their eyes, although some women have a fourth cone. So if your wife tells you that she knows she sees better color than you do, she might be right. I don't know why that particular characteristic is sex-linked, but it seems to be men are more likely to be colorblind, women are more likely to have the fourth cone, which is still very rare. It's only like 2% of the population, but still, like, it is a sex-linked characteristic. But color emerges. There are languages which only have color words for light and dark. And then red is always the third one to come after that, then yellow, blue, and green in some order because of the structure of our eyes and how cones sense. And then you get into the pinks and grays and other sort of more secondary colors, purple. But there's a very predictable order in which over time color words emerge in languages. So that's from the linguistic side. The cognitive scientists were interested in the differences between computer programming and human thought, and why it was so easy to program computers to do some things that are hard for humans, like playing chess, and so hard to train computers for things that are second nature to us, like figuring out how to get out of a room, or pick up a coffee cup that's not exactly like every other coffee cup that they've seen before. And out of this comes this sort of rich theory of how human beings think that we talked on Monday about four different major kinds of blends, we call them, which out of which our language and thinking emerge. And so we think as embodied beings. We think as upright bipedal mammals, and so we conceive of affection in terms of the metaphor of warmth. Because as infants, our first experiences of affection are deeply connected to being held by our warm-blooded parents. So when I say to you, he's such a warm person, she is so cold-hearted, those metaphors are part of sort of the kind of creatures that we are. But then metaphors also emerge in culture in ways that progress over time. We talked a little bit on Monday about the rise of monotheism, and then how saying that Jesus is Messiah changed the possibilities of what could be said about both Jesus and Messiahhood, such that 2,000 years of Christian theology have sort of arisen out of this productive tension of holding together the very surprising Messiah Jesus. Right? In a way that is so surprising that none of his disciples got it. We've got all these stories in the New Testament about the disciples not understanding what Jesus is saying when he's telling them he's going to be Messiah. Or even after the cross, walking towards Emmaus, absolutely confused about what's going on. And this insight that Jesus is Lord, which is the sort of earliest Christian creed, right? Jesus is Lord. Jesus is the one who saves. If he saves, he must be God in some way. And this strange being is Messiah. Changes the possibilities of what can be said, and ends up making reinterpretations of everything that had come before, not in a way that undid it, but in a way that opened up new ways you can say things. So that all of the stuff that Isaiah is saying about the people of Israel in their exile ends up being re-understood as prophecy about this one laborer who was killed by the Roman Empire. Right? You see the kinds of things we're talking about here? So that's the sort of basic underlying structure of all this stuff. So what I'd like to move into then is talking about what happens when we dialogue with people who operate in related but different metaphoric worlds than the ones we inhabit. Because we inhabit these worlds most of the time without noticing the pieces of it. Right? So when you were talking to people this morning at breakfast, my guess is you weren't saying, well, that's a really interesting metaphor that they're using. Or, you know, they said the temperature might go up later this afternoon. Temperature doesn't actually go up. Molecules move faster. That's a metaphoric construction for what's happening later today. No, you just said the temperature went up, right? Metacognition is... If we were trying to do all the metacognitional work all the time, it would be impossible. In fact, language would be impossible if we didn't have metaphor, because metaphor compacts things. We think of one thing in terms of another thing. If we weren't able to do that, every single dog that you met, you would have to figure out what it was. One of the reasons, this is a side note, but I find it fascinating. One of the reasons that some people think that that dogs and cats have such problems engaging with each other is that they have fairly opposite body languages for dominance and submission. And any individual dog or cat can figure out that this animal that they share a house with, this particular dog or cat, is a very strange, so let's say we're talking about a cat. This cat can figure out that this dog it lives with is a very strange cat that signals everything backwards, and over time they can work it out. But then that cat meets another dog and they can't say, oh yeah, this one's just like Fido. Huh. Once again, they've got a cat in front of them and they can't read it right, and so you get escalating patterns of dominance and submission that get really out of hand, right? I think that's oftentimes what happens to us, especially when we find ourselves in situations where we think we share a culture and we don't. And ecumenism is a really good example for this. And one of the reasons I really enjoy studying it is because Christians both have a deep and historic commitment to unity and a deep and historic commitment to the truth. So we say in the Creed, I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. So there can only be one church. So... And in the Reformation, people were really clear about this, right? The Lutherans and the Catholics were saying to each other, well, if you're not church, then you're not church. So we live in such an ecumenical world at this point that sometimes we have to remember that. That it's a really strange thing for Christians to look at Christians who they're not in communion with and say, well, that's okay. It's okay that the Methodists are not in communion with us. That's actually a deeply unchristian thing to do. If we don't notice that the divisions between Christians strike at the heart of the actual Christian gospel. Because think about Jesus' metaphors that he uses, right? He talks about, I am the vine and you are the branches. Any branch that is cut off dies and is thrown into the fire. Well, if what we're doing in the communion, in the Eucharist, is enacting, working out a visual, communal, embodied metaphor for that kind of unity, then when we say to each other, you may not commune here, or I will not commune with you, we are enacting the cutting off of those vines. Now, why in the world would Christians do that, right? That seems to go against the gospel. But the other thing that we are deeply, deeply committed to is truth. And Christianity became theologized in a way that many other religions aren't, fairly early on in the arguments over who Jesus is.
Yeah, the creedal period.
Which is important, right? Why, and why is it important that we figure out who Jesus is? Why did Christians spend 300 years arguing until we get to, well, past we get Nicaea? Right, the thing we call the Nicene Creed is actually the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed. Why? Because after Nicaea, you've got Ephesus II that says, no, that's not right. And then you've got Constantinople that comes back and says, oh, wait, yes, actually, Nicaea was right. Ephesus II was a robber council. Well, why? Gregory of Nyssa, it was Gregory of Nyssa, right, Stephen, who says that people are fighting at the baker shop?
I'm not sure.
It's one of the Cappadocians. I think it's Gregory of Nyssa. Anyone else know? So he talks about going down to the baker shop and sees people getting into a fight over the difference between homoousius and homoousius.
One iota.
Right, one iota. But it's a really important iota, right?
It almost split, you could say it helped to split the church.
It did. And this is, but it's over a question of, is Jesus really God? And Gregory and his friends were convinced that if that iota was there, and Jesus wasn't really God the way God the Father is God, then we're not saved. Then being connected to Jesus, who in the Gospel of John says, whoever knows me knows the Father, doesn't in fact save us. So if Christians are in this bind where both truth and unity are really, really important. And so in the 20th century, I find Christian ecumenism so fascinating because we have Christians who've been separate from each other for 500 years and are very used to saying to each other, you're not a Christian, right? I'm a Roman Catholic. And when my grandparents were children, they were told not to play with people who were of a different religion. Now, what were their parents really worried about?
Probably that the children would grow up in a different faith or leave the faith, I would guess.
Sure, and why were they worried that their children might leave the faith if they played with other kids?
If they were serious about salvation, if they were serious.
Okay, but why were they worried that playing with other kids would lead to them leaving the church?
They might marry someone from another
faith. That's what they're really worried about, right? That if they had too many friends who were something else, they might marry those people, and then you're in this situation where somebody's going to leave and somebody's going to be wrong, right? So in the 20th century, Christians who had been in this posture towards each other started in this slowly having conversations, and Protestants were faster at this than Roman Catholics. In the Protestant world, it's really started with the Edinburgh Missionary Conference in 1910, at which Christians from a number of Protestant denominations came together to talk about how to do mission better, specifically at that point in Africa and Asia. And they kept saying, how can we preach this gospel if we're separated from each other? And so it's important to heal, for the sake of truth, it is important to heal the breaks in unity. If we want to teach truth to the world, we have to do it together. So that leads to the Faith and Order and the Life and Work movements that eventually together become the World Council of Churches. Catholics are still very skeptical about all this until leading up to the Second Vatican Council, a couple of Catholic theologians got permission to go to one of the Faith and Order things, but the Vatican said, okay, you can go, but you have to go as journalists. You can't go as theologians. And then at the Second Vatican Council, the Catholic Church invited Protestants, George Lindbeck was one of them, to come and observe the council and see what was going on, right? And then Lutherans and Catholics, including George Lindbeck, spent 50 years trying to sort of go back to the questions that had divided the churches in the 16th century. And over the course of these dialogues, a number of surprising things happened. So there's two major things at issue, broadly speaking, between Protestants and Catholics in the Reformation. This is overbroad, but this is a short class. Justification is one of them, and ecclesiology is the other one. And the two of them fit into each other and merge, whatever. And yes, there's a lot of sacramental stuff, although less than you think between Lutherans and Catholics. That's more as we get towards the radical reform. So justification, how are we made right with God? And ecclesiology, how should the church be structured? What does God intend for us together? And most of the 50 years, they talked about ecclesiology, but justification was the thing, partly because Lutherans were driving this conversation. And as you all know, Lutherans care a lot about justification, right? And so over 50 years, they had these conversations over and over and over again about justification. And Lutherans were, you know, the what are the stories we tell about each other when it comes to justification? What story do Lutherans historically tell about Catholics? How do Catholics think that we're saved, according to the old stories?
By paying for it.
Okay, so one thing we talk about is by paying. So we've got the Middle Ages, the sort of indulgences thing, which did happen. You can pay for it.
Earning it. You have to work your way to God. And the oversimplification, Lutherans say that God comes to you. That's the way I was taught.
Okay, so one of the ways of telling the story is, but by the way, which every year there's a survey that comes out from Pew, which I detest. I love Pew, but I hate the survey. And every year they do this survey about religious knowledge in the United States. And you'll see it on Facebook, right? And people will say, I got 10 out of 10 on this question, on this thing. And one of the questions they ask is, structured exactly this way, Protestants think that we are saved by, the survey says, by faith, which would be a different kind of Pelagianism if it were true, right? What does Luther say? Saved by grace through faith, right? The survey says Protestants think we're saved by faith, and Catholics think we're saved by works. That's the old story we tell.
Those are the only two.
And notice that in the 16th century, the Council of Trent accuses Lutherans of being Pelagians. You know what Pelagians are?
No.
Pelagian is one of the earliest heresies. We can think of it as self-help Christianity. Yeah. You are responsible for saving yourself. In the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, the Lutheran World Federation sort of played off of this in some interesting ways, talking about justification not for sale. Right? Humans not for sale, so working against human trafficking. Creation not for sale, working against ecological degradation, right? But so this idea then that Catholics at the Council of Trent really say, if you think that your faith saves you, what you're doing is saying that you save yourself. Of course, is that what Luther's saying? Did anyone in the room have to memorize the Small Catechism?
Yeah.
When they were a kid?
Yeah.
How does the creed start in the Small Catechism? What does this mean?
Fear, trust, and love God, such... Go ahead.
That's the commandments.
Darn.
The creed starts, I believe that I cannot... Oh, shoot. That I cannot of my own something believe in God or save myself. So if only belief, if even belief, right? Because how does the creed start? Credo. Credo in unum Deum. I believe in one God, right? If even belief has to be a gift from God, Luther says, if the faith that saves us is God's own gift, then that's not Pelagianism. But that's an easy piece to leave behind, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Because God is, that's why it's salvation by grace through faith. That it's God's free gift that saves us. Meanwhile, Catholics are concerned that, and this sometimes happens in some forms of Lutheran theology, that if you follow out what people are actually saying, the person that is saved might not be me. So, for example, Thomas Aquinas is very firm on the fact that if God is going to save us, and if God's going to save me, right? Remember we talked, those of you who are here on Wednesday, I said, that which is received according to the mode of the receiver, right? If the person who's going to be saved is me, and I'm a human being, then there has to be a continuity between me and the person who is saved, because human beings are historical, right? And some ways of telling the story of justification historically have said, justification is a return to the origin. It's the return to the garden as if history never happened. As a way of preserving the gratuity of it all, that I don't earn it, right? But the problem with that is then that's not me. That's the sort of, think about your sort of Star Trek universe here, right? That's the going back in time to the me that could have been if there hadn't been sin. But if it's going to be me who's saved, Thomas argues, then there has to be a continuity between here and there, not just a break. Which means I'm going to have to be involved in the process of being saved. Not in such a way that I earn it, right? But in such a way that there's a continuity, that there's a through line. You can sort of you could follow the line along. This is, by the way, where the Catholic idea about purgatory comes from. How do you deal with the fact that when Grandma died, she was kind of a terrible human being? Does it mean she's going to hell? Well, it could. Or if there's salvation for Grandma, there has to be a sort of in-between moment. There has to be a continuity between the Grandma who is still kind of an awful person and the Grandma who becomes her redeemed self by God's grace.
I think it's really helpful for those of us who maybe come from a Lutheran background to know that Catholics think about... I'm only going to talk about three more seconds. To know that Catholics officially teach it not as a doctrine of purgatory, but as purgation, that it's a process and not a place in modern Catholic teaching. So and that's helpful.
But do you see what I'm saying? What the concern is? Thank you, Stephen. That's really helpful. So the concern for Catholics is that. It's this purgation, not there is a place called purgatory, but God makes me whole somehow in a way that it's still me. So in the course of this whole dialogue, I want to point to a couple of things that happened that are really important. As Lutherans and Catholics talk to each other annually, ongoingly, for more than 50 years, they found that some of the questions that they were disagreeing about were not necessarily the things that they were disagreeing about. So we talked on Monday about concupiscence, which is the disorder of desire, and how when Lutherans and Catholics were disagreeing about whether or not concupiscence was sinful, they eventually came to a point where they were able to say, when Catholics say that concupiscence is not sin, they're saying that because they want to say that baptism is effective. And if baptism doesn't remove concupiscence, then it wouldn't do anything, right? It wouldn't save us. Meanwhile, when Lutherans were saying that concupiscence is sin, they were saying that concupiscence was part of the world that needed to be healed before heaven. That it wouldn't be, this was not God's desire. One way of cashing this out is to say this: they're not disagreeing about concupiscence, they're disagreeing about how they use the word sin, the metaphoric construction of sin. Lutherans are saying sin is anything that is not God's final desire for us, that which needs to be redeemed. Catholics are saying sin are those things which prevent us from being in a relationship with God such that he saved us. Do you see the difference between those two things? So here's sort of point one for today. The answer is not always the question. If you don't know the question that the answer is answering, you don't understand the answer. I always tell my students this is a different theological example, but hopefully one that's easier to wrap your mind around. The doctrine of the Trinity is an answer to a question. If you don't spend the time to figure out what the question is, the doctrine of the Trinity is not going to be very helpful to you. And I'm sure most of you have probably sat through Trinity Sunday homilies that didn't pay any attention to the question that the Trinity is actually answering, and started talking about blueberry pies cut into thirds, which is heresy, or shamrocks, which is also heresy, or, you know, all of these other images that treat the question of it as if it's how can three actually be one. The doctrine of the Trinity is answering the question, how is it possible that Jesus is God and there is one God? Why in the world can we call Jesus Lord, say that Jesus saves, and still be monotheists? We're not going to get the answer to that today. But that's the question it's answering, right? That's why people care so much. The second thing that happened in this period of 50 years was, in a new way, for possibly the first real time since the Diet of Regensburg, which was the last sort of hope of reconciliation before final splits in the 16th century, Lutherans and Catholics approached the table not necessarily saying, I am here to prove that I am right and you are wrong, but saying, I am here to have a conversation about our differences, to understand what's going on here. And so one of the rules that developed in ecumenical dialogue over that time is you are not allowed to judge the rightness of another person's argument until, you should at some point judge the rightness of another person's argument, but you're not allowed to do it until you can articulate it in such a way that they recognize it as their own. until you can say to them, what I hear you saying is this. And they say, yes, I recognize that as what I'm saying. Then you can start having a conversation about whether or not it's right. And that's a really hard thing to do, right? There's a Canadian, no longer alive, Canadian Jesuit philosopher by the name of Bernard Lonergan, who talks about what we do when we think. And he divides the sort of process of it broadly into four movements. Bernard Lonergan really likes sort of dividing things. He's there's lumpers and there's splitters. He's definitely a splitter. How do you make all the distinctions you can make? So he's famously for using the words like 64thly. In his writing, he's impossible to read. But this is really helpful. So he has what he calls the four transcendental precepts, which are be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. I'm going to write those down. Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. And these movements are, you can think of them in terms of four questions. Attentive asks, what is this thing? What is it? Intelligent asks, what does this thing mean? How does it fit into everything else? How does it relate to other things that I know? How does it, because meaning is relational, right? Everything means in terms of other things. How does this thing fit into the systems that it coheres in? The question for reasonable is it true? Understanding how this thing fits into the systems, is it true? So what is it? What does it mean? Is it true? And then finally, responsible, what should I do about it? And I can tell you from teaching a lot of undergraduate writing that our temptation is to jump from what is it to what should I do about it? To not take the time to assume that we know what things mean and whether or not they're true. My undergraduates tend to assume that having read an article once, they can then make grand statements about, you know, the nature of the world and the truth of things. And we do this all the time because we don't really have time, most of the time, to sit down and do this kind of pondering, right? And most of the time, we don't need to. When you're on dish team and you are scrubbing a plate, if you spent time pondering each plate and the meaning of cleanliness and sort of what you need to do is clean the plates and put them in the dish thing, right? Because there's a lot of them to get through. Even when we are, when we're thinking about things, most of the time we assume these middle steps, right? We jump through them very quickly because we have a pretty good grasp on the cultures that we inhabit, right? Like I said this morning at breakfast, nobody was thinking about the metaphor of temperature, of heat. You know what it means already. You've done that work. If you ever hang around 2 and 3-year-olds, they do this work out loud, right? And you sort of watch them build their metaphoric networks over time. So we can say, for example, kids will first develop, see this cup, right? See this cup. The next thing that they'll develop is, see what I did? I put the cup down, right? Now, that's not there anymore to see. You saw it, but do you see what I did? The third thing they develop is, do you see what I mean? So the metaphor of sight as knowledge develops in predictable ways. And if you say to a kid who's just learning, do you see what I mean? They're not going to know right away what you mean. But once you've developed the network, once you understand how it means in the system, then you can sort of move more quickly past those steps. When we find ourselves in situations like ecumenical dialogue, we often have to remind ourselves that we are toddlers learning to speak a new language. Because if we take seriously that Lutherans and Catholics, for example, speak the faith by means of different languages, different ways of using the word sin, for example, we can't immediately trust that we speak the language up front of the other, which is why it's so important to be able to speak back to somebody in new words, not just repeating what they said, right? but repeat back to them what they said in such a way that they recognize it as their own. When I was at Marquette, I taught sections of the Intro to Theology class that were explicitly designed for students from China, because we'd found that we had a lot of students from China at Marquette who had grown up in not in entirely not just non-Christian but non-religious, intentionally atheistic culture, and they had a lot of trouble passing the Intro to Theology class because most people who grew up here, even if they didn't grow up Christian, knew a lot of how that worked.
You had to think that.
Right. So I was teaching this class, and we got to the doctrine of the Trinity. And the first year I taught it, they were repeating back to me exactly what I said. And then I gave them an essay exam, and they had no idea what I was talking about. They had memorized my words, but not understood what they meant. And so that second year that I taught it, we started doing conceptual mapping, where I was forcing them to turn what I was saying into pictures. And then I knew that they'd gotten it, and when they wrote their exam 2 weeks later, they did much better. Right? So oftentimes, when I say you have to be able to repeat back to somebody what they mean, such that they recognize it, you have to be able to say it in a different way, such that they recognize it. In your own words, such that they recognize it. Does that make sense? Why that's important? A question that can be really helpful in this is, responsible. We do in fact have to decide what to do about it eventually, right? So Lutherans and Catholics decided eventually that they had to come out with the Joint Declaration, which officially said for the first time in 500 years that the condemnations, the legal condemnations of the other person's opinions, or what they thought were the other person's opinions, did not apply to the contemporary partner. So Lutherans and Catholics decided what they had to do was not repeal the Council of Trent, not repeal the Augsburg Confession, but to say the condemnations in these documents do not apply to you. Which puts us in a situation now where, of the two major hurdles to unity, justification and ecclesiology, we can say it's ecclesiology that's the next big hurdle. And at some point in the future, I hope that what we need to do will be to say, we recognize you fully as church and we'll commune with you, right? That's the goal of the ecumenical movement, to restore that unity which God desires for the church. But we do have to judge. And at some point we may have to judge and say, this is not the gospel. Right? The Council of Trent was making a decision based on the best that they knew that this was not the gospel. Should anyone say, in the language of Trent, should anyone say that they are saved by their own faith, let them be anathema. That's a decision. Right? If you say this, you're outside the community of faith because you're a Pelagian. So in the midst of this, there's a question that we should pay a lot more attention to, and it has to do with this intelligent step, the what does it mean? And that's the why question. So when someone comes to us with a belief that we just find crazy, that just we can't figure out how it fits into any sane person's vision of the universe, it sounds to me like you're being a Pelagian. Why in the world would you want to that, right? We should ask why. What's at stake in this for you? I remember once I was sitting in a class. I don't even remember what the conversation was about. It was a class on hymnody at Valparaiso back in the 90s. And the class felt like we were bouncing back and forth between about three different views of what worship was over the whole semester. And anytime we'd get close to something that somebody wanted to protect, we'd have a fight. You've probably run into this before in some kind of place. I said the other day that this often happens in our culture around questions of what we should do about abortion. That one group of people is protecting the sanctity of life. Another group of people is protecting the autonomy of women, the non-control of women by a patriarchal structure, right? And they name themselves differently. They seem to be fighting about different questions. And all of the polling tells us that the vast majority of Americans fall somewhere between what we think of as absolutely incommensurate poles. Right? That there should be, the vast majority of Americans think that there should be limits on abortion and that it shouldn't be entirely outlawed, right? But we don't treat the question that way because we're protecting different goods. It is a good that women are allowed to be autonomous. It is a good that we do not kill human life in whatever form, right? And rarely do we actually have conversations about what we're trying to protect in a way that leave room to have that conversation with somebody who's trying to protect something different. We jump straight to what should we do about it? Who should we elect? Who should be on the Supreme Court? What kind of laws should be in place? So one of the things that happens in the Lutheran Catholic dialogue is, because theologians are, you know, really like history, we spent a lot of time writing, not me, they spent a lot of time writing papers trying to explain why Lutherans cared so deeply historically about these questions and why Catholics cared so deeply about these questions and trying to disentangle the pieces of it where Lutherans care so deeply about the centrality of justification because it doesn't mean they're, it means they're not Catholic, that's one reason, from the centrality of justification is really important because for Luther, it is the doctrine by which the church stands or falls because the church is always tempted to try and save itself. If you want to read really interesting Luther, the first 8 volumes of Luther's works are over across the hall in the library. They are his sermons on Genesis from the last 10 years of his life, and they are fascinating because Luther is preaching to his students about the scriptures, working his way through Genesis, and he is absolutely convinced that from the very beginning of humanity, humans want to save themselves. The fall in Eden is about humans wanting to save themselves. Cain and Abel is about wanting to save ourselves, not being open to God's salvation. They know that this Messiah is coming, Luther thinks, and yet we keep setting up false churches by which we are in control. He's absolutely convinced, as a good medieval theologian, that pride was the central sin out of which all of the others came. Right? So that's the thing he's trying to protect, not we believe in justification by grace through faith because it makes us not Catholic, which some later Lutherans might have held on to, right? So they wrote these historical papers. They tried to explain to each other why they cared so deeply about the formulations that they thought were important. And they came to say, our positions are not compatible, but they're not contradictory. Which is a really funny thing to say if you think about it. I promise we'll take a break in 2 minutes. Avery Cardinal Dulles, who is a member of a lot of these dialogues on the Roman Catholic side, you might recognize the name Dulles Airport in D.C. was named for his dad, big American political family. He became a Jesuit. Well, he became a Catholic first, and then he became a Jesuit. I can't imagine what his dad thought about those things. Dulles said at the end of the Joint Declaration, this is really important and really good, but I don't want people to think that it means that a Lutheran should come into a Catholic pulpit and preach as a Lutheran. Or a Catholic come into a Lutheran pulpit and preach as a Catholic. Because there's such a possibility of misunderstanding the language of the other people without doing this work. Right? So it's not that it does away with differences. Lutheran ways of talking about justification, concupiscence, is sin, and Catholic ways of talking about justification, concupiscence, is not sin, remain incompatible, but we've discovered that they're not contradictory. Think about it this way. French and English are not contradictory to each other, but they're incompatible. If I walk into my classroom, we'll go with German because I speak much better German than French. If I walk into my classroom in Texas, and start teaching my class in German, my students are not going to know what's going on, right? Now imagine that I'm doing it in Chaucerian English. They might pick up pieces of it, and they might get exactly the wrong idea, right? Because in Chaucer's English, meat means vegetables, right? The way that language changes over time. That's what Dulles is worried about, that these ways of speaking remain incompatible. You can't necessarily, in all cases, Lutheran Catholics love to sing Lutheran hymns, so we use a lot of those things, but you have to be careful about how these things fit in the systems. But they're not, but we've discovered that they're not contradictory, and therefore we don't have to condemn each other over them. Although, and this is important, we leave up the guideposts, the borders, that both the Council of Trent and the Augsburg Confession put in place, because those things are in fact still distortions of the gospel. You can get this wrong, right? It's really easy to become a Pelagian, to be saving yourself in either system. And so we together say those things and say, one of the things we have to do about this is say, these things are not Christian. You see what I'm saying here? About how this is a complex thing. We're gonna take a 5-minute break. When we come back, we can have some time for questions. And then I'm gonna do an even more sort of emotional thing. We're gonna talk about politics for a minute, and then we're gonna wrap up by asking you to think about where those spaces are in your engagements with other people, maybe in families, maybe in politics, maybe in other places, where it might be helpful to go back and ask some of these questions about why, and why is this important, and what's going on here. Okay? So 5 minutes, it's 20 past, I'll see you at 25 past.
Jacob, what's this about Gregory in the bakery?
He talks about going to a bakery and seeing two people get into a fist fight over the homoousius versus the homoousius.
No.
Which?
Isn't there the legend about Gregory of Nyssa punching a Pelagian?
That's
Nassianus?
Nicholas of Smyrna.
Yeah.
So the legend is that St. Nicholas gets to the council, who becomes Santa, right? Gets to the Council of Nicaea and punches Pelagius and gets put in prison by the other bishops for acting in a way unlike a bishop, and Jesus lets him out. But the other bishops tell him he can't wear his bishop hat anymore because he hasn't been acting.
So he gets a red hat with a white costume.
Exactly. No. Oh. But so if you see Eastern icons of St. Nicholas, he's not wearing a mitre.
That's cool. Yeah. I've never heard of a bakery thing. It's so far.
Hey, Jacob.
Yeah. How are you?
Steve.
Good
to meet you. I'm Steve.
Have your churches to things or agreement
like my yellow breakfast.
Yeah. It's good to meet you too, man.
I wish we lived down the street.
Are you in Virginia?
It's more complicated.
Okay.
So there were churches 100 years ago who
bowed their leadership.
So actually, in the 60s, before Roe v. Wade, a lot of American Protestants were
Protestant.
Yeah.
That's where I went to Southern as well.
That would be important.
Huge graduate.
Actually, yeah.
So the medieval argument about it was that
my church is a professor.
Sure.
There was something they taught about.
I worked for him in the opposite position for a while,
which basically so when you start telling the child to move around, why
is he saying it in there?
Yeah.
And so Thomas will still, because the soul is under his body, right? And so people will say that there was some wilderness words.
In my life, the
growth in biology.
So Jacob and I met at college. I went to Southern Seminary, and then was a pastor in the Iowa City area for about 7 years.
Where'd you go?
Yeah, but like there's six ways they talked to any.
You know, they had some really good theologians on faculty at the time I was living, and right.
So maybe
and they trained pastors. That was why.
Yeah, they did good. Good ministry preparation.
Right.
I also just been in the Midwest my whole life.
So the
I was single and young and kind of thought might as well check out a new
part of the world,
right? Builds on
that biology.
That doesn't
now?
So
Gregory would be sitting
there.
Well,
again, it's kind of
I did a hobby. It was part of the PhD at Marquette in theology, like John did. Except he finished his book. I didn't finish mine. Right now I'm stay-at-home dad.
A left turn.
Too much for the church. Just go.
Right. So that's the Catholic argument now.
Sometimes I'll look at the essays for them.
And so when Catholics
do some editing or whatever,
are talking about abortion, they're assuming that.
Hang out with my family.
Life
where until they're over in Decorah.
And if that's the case, then this is the whole
Decorah, Iowa.
I'm looking at
it. Shake a tree, three Lutherans will follow.
That's it. It's a great little city.
Like Poland, shake a tree, three Catholics will follow.
I'd love to go to Poland someday.
Amazing people. Really beautiful people.
Yeah, that country's been through some political upheaval in the past few years.
I mean, that's only if you think
it's just that not as a real argument, but just conceptually.
Fully.
Their language and the Catholic Church is what kept them alive for 200-300 years. They had 125 years without
it. The
Austro-Hungarian Empire got divided up. They didn't even have a country.
The Church didn't handle the language of that.
And they fought to hold on to both of those. Even under Soviet control.
The most important thing is when that creates a score.
Catholic Party said you can't go to church. Even Catholics that didn't believe went as a statement of solidarity.
It's the whole thing.
Absolutely.
If you look at our
absolutely.
Did they have an
opinion?
A lot of my friends said their parents were in a
relationship. A lot of this stuff works.
How do you tell Poland not to put your
hand on it? Just say, you got to throw us in jail, you got to throw all of us.
How do I become a better human?
And Soviets roll tanks. They roll tanks.
And when
they come up against the limitations of my ability,
I live on the other side. 38 years old, always second hand. LA, I had a San Diego. But he came to Krakow. He became a parish priest in Krakow. He returned to Krakow in 87, 88, and walked in there. He threw the power of the church behind the solidarity movement. They were kind of about 1.2 million people in Krakow. There were 1.5 million people.
Right, so Salvation is a mass
part. Right. A big park called the Boynia. I used to run around the Boynia.
Fullness of relationship with God that Jesus says.
And that was one of the tipping points.
I've heard about that. People visit quite a few times in various magazines, those things, just how important it was for
how do we help people become full humans?
Or of a mind.
You know,
Yes,
but I found it interesting. I don't know if any of you watched the Chernobyl miniseries.
I have not
seen it now.
Classical theism is that Gorbachev
would say,
basically
God
says
is absolutely non-contingent.
That was the beginning.
That is the
of
only non-contingent being.
Yeah,
that Chernobyl was.
In other words,
yeah, for him.
And actually, when you watch the series, it's like I get it. Why that was the case?
Why that would cause him to get disillusioned with?
Does it matter?
Yeah.
Does it make a difference to God?
Chernobyl was in Eastern Germany. No,
it was in Siberia, right?
His final question, right back a couple days later, it says, yes,
the Ukraine is on the border.
Because if God's non-temporal, God can't change.
And they can't.
Right? And
there's
so
still people.
If
they're not making
God,
a vodka.
Absolute separation from creation.
Called Chernobyl vodka.
Creation is dependent on God. It's not dependent on
creation. Vodka's all over Poland. I'm not a vodka drinker. But
it's going to explode.
I just I'm not quite ready yet to.
That, you know, God is who
just going to let other people try it and wait 20 years.
You're going to mellow it out.
Let that turn green.
Let's see what happens to their.
I don't know. Something's got to kill you.
See if what their children look like, you know. And we'll take a chance, maybe.
Depends on what you mean by exerts its will. Because, again, sure, but influences as creator.
Oh, right.
Which doesn't necessarily like
it. Just the first domino?
No, because God's not temporal. So if God's outside of time, then creation is an ongoing thing. Because God would have to relate to all of time equally. The first domino, in a sense, makes God into Zeus.
Really frustrating.
Because it puts God in this, like, he's another billiard ball on the table. This is why monotheism is so hard to hold on to, right? Because we end up having to say, God is not.
I saw you were on
the
side, there were three of you that said you never had any doubts.
You know, like there's a.
I thought, that's amazing, that's cool.
I noticed that too.
I'm sorry, I was supposed to say that.
Oh, but I was here.
You were in the room, okay.
Wait. I know, I did something like that too this morning.
So,
really, like other things in our daily life, you think would be more important, but yet this is something that.
So there's a guy, a Jesuit, who wrote a book called The Mighty from Their Thrones, which is a theology of the Old Testament. It's very interestingly done, in which he argues that changes in theology produce changes in politics, such that power and what it's for are wielded. So on some level, all of these questions are speculative, metaphysical, whatever, right? But on another level, every time that they change who wields power and what power is for. So it's not like it doesn't matter.
So
you
can't actually create those kind of things. So, curiosity.
I had some friends present.
Because there's implications for us also, right? If we have, so I lived in Utah for a while, and there's all kinds of voice to the Mormonism is just wrong.
about who it says the God is. So a lot of them had me do with gender.
And Catholic.
Those kinds of things.
Had to go.
And if it's just about sort of being right and the front brain, it may not be very important.
And
right?
God.
But there are implications for how people live.
Which made us late.
Right, so Mormonism.
So
I can make a Christian argument
she
for
said,
why
we're going to the
Did you talk about the Jesuits? One of my husbands going to Loyola in Chicago. There's a teacher there who wrote a book. I can't remember the name of it, but it was kind of along the lines of Peter's fourth denial. And that the fourth denial was that Peter went out and created the church. And the idea being that Jesus didn't want an organizational structure to be part of his, you know, that's not what he was after.
It feels to me
when
more
he
like
went out in the world and just performed his, you know, did what he did. He didn't try to set up an organizational structure with all these words
what are the
and
truths and rules and laws
and all that stuff. That,
I mean, without reading the book, I can comment on it, obviously, but it feels to me more like 60s politics rather than good theology.
So,
I can comment on without having read the book.
Did you read it?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
so because Peter doesn't set up the church, right? The church develops over a period of 1,000-2,000 years.
But he's called like the rock, you know.
Sure, he's called the rock. Yeah, but Peter is, but like the city of Rome doesn't have bishops until the 2nd century, right? That develops to answer needs of the community over time. Right? Why do we need bishops? Well, we need bishops because it turns out the communities who don't have central authority structures tend to fall apart over time. The ones that have authority structures are more stable, right? And so then the question is, how do you manage the authority structure such that it doesn't become its own kind of idolatry, right? And so, like, it's not like Peter went to Rome and said, I am the Pope, right? Although Catholics have sometimes argued that that's the case. So it's bad history to say that Peter sets up the church, right? Because Peter's been dead by 150 years by the time you have the first single bishop in Rome. And so, more interesting to me as a question is, how do we authentically enter into the ongoing development of the church in light of the gospel?
A greater divide.
Recognizing that we can't change history. Because this is a very, in some sense, there's a very Protestant undertone to this Jesuit's writing. Mm-hmm. Because he's saying, how do we find the original church back behind all of this mess? There's an Episcopalian priest, Ephraim Radner, who wrote a book that suggests that the American model of problems is to withdraw and try again. We're going to go off to the mountains and found a community that's perfect. We're going to get away from all you sinners and go to a place where we can do it right.
And then bring the truth back. Cool. Then bring the truth back.
Hopefully,
to you.
Yeah. And so, but the problem with that is that 15 years later, your kids are going to say, well, this is screwed up.
Yeah.
Because we've brought humanness with us. I mean,
you can't shake it up.
Right. So I don't know a church that doesn't have problematic politics, mm-hmm. no matter what their structure is. Quakers will tell you that their structure does not prevent problematic politics or sect abuse or any of the rest of it, right?
It's problematic politics are baked into the whole story of salvation. I mean,
yeah, no, right, exactly.
God preferentially works with screwed up people.
Yeah,
in scripture.
You've got David.
What choice is there?
Yeah. Like he picks the most screwed up person and makes him king over and over and over.
As an organizational consultant, the concept is every organizational structure is a choice among dilemmas. You in a sense, choose which dilemmas you'd rather live with. There's no...
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Hmm. So let me give an ecumenical example of this. We've apparently gotten back into our conversation. So
yeah.
Welcome back, everyone.
I think we've started.
Go ahead.
Let's think about Orthodox modes, Eastern Orthodox modes of structuring church versus Roman Catholic modes of structuring church. The Roman Catholic mode has bishops who have a decent amount of local autonomy,
But then a Poku can step in problem areas and fix things when they happen. Which can mean, and has historically meant, that you end up with bad popes who really screw things up sometimes. But the Eastern Orthodox model means that, for example, the joint declaration couldn't happen in the same way with the Orthodox, or it's much more complicated that it would happen with the Orthodox churches than with the Lutheran church, with the Roman Catholic church. Because, you know, the Catholic church and the Orthodox churches have been having fairly good ecumenical relationships for the last 15 years, getting better. But about 4 years ago, a couple of bishops in Greece wrote a letter to the prince of the Vatican City State calling on him to abjure of his heresies and return to the church. Now, who's the prince of the Vatican City State? Pope Francis, yeah. And so they won't even recognize that he's a bishop. And the ecumenical patriarch who calls the Greek churches into community can't say to those bishops, this is wrong, you can't do that, right?
They have very decentralized authority.
Right, yeah, they have, right. So there's a different, or let's think about how the joint declaration was pulled together. And there's good and bad things on both sides of this. When the joint declaration was being approved after it was written, on the Roman Catholic side, it went to the Congregation on the Doctrine of the Faith and the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity in Rome. And they said, we have three or four quick questions. If we can get answers to those, it's fine. And Cardinal Ratzinger called some Lutheran friends together at his brother's house in Bavaria. And over a couple of weekends, they hammered out some answers to that. And then Cardinal Ratzinger went to Pope John Paul II, and Pope John Paul II said, go for it, and they signed it. On the Lutheran side, the Lutherans had to write to every member church and ask them whether they recognized this as an authentic engagement with the gospel. 90-some% of churches wrote back. Of those, 94% of churches wrote back. Of those, there were only 6 no votes. There were, that's not true, there were 6%. Yeah, 6 no votes. There were, however, 3 votes that no one could figure out what they meant. So the Danes, for example, said, we cannot accept this as another symbol of the faith, which would put it at the same level as the Creed and the Augsburg Confession. Well, no one was asking them to do that.
That wasn't
so they answered a question that nobody asked. And I mentioned the Japanese, the Kinki Lutheran Church the other day, who said, we cannot accept this because it doesn't solve the 16th century problem, right? The Germans have their own super complicated church structure, whereby every state church, so like say the Church of Washington, be like synods here, the state churches all belong to the Evangelical Church of Germany. Some of them also belong to the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches in Germany, and some of them belong to the Calvinist Association within the EKD. So within that, you have some churches that don't even really call themselves Lutherans, weighing in on this thing, and a number of Calvinist university professors saying this is not Lutheran faith in the German system, right? So it gets really messy. And eventually what ended up happening was the International Council of the Lutheran World Federation said, having read all of these things, we believe that the churches are affirming it. But they had, this is only, and that's only the second time that the Council of the LWF has spoken in that way on behalf of the whole Lutheran world body. The other time was to stand up against apartheid in South Africa. So in a sense, they had to invent a central structure. Yeah.
So when they spoke out against apartheid, did all of them do it as a, was there 60, 40, 90, 10?
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. So,
but they did it on behalf of...
They did it on behalf of the whole, so they could say that the Lutheran Church is against apartheid, right?
Okay.
But...
That answers my question.
Yeah, I was about 3 years old when that happened, so I wasn't paying that close attention to your politics yet.
You were still trying to figure out the coffee cup, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to figure out how to put the coffee cup. So I guess what I'm saying is, when we talk about ecclesiology, one of the things that we are, part of the reason that justification was easier to solve than ecclesiology is because as important as justification is, it has fewer day-to-day impacts on how people live their lives in the church. Let me give you a very Lutheran example of this. In the late 90s, the ELCA was coming up with, was it late 90s, early 2000s maybe? There were two ecumenical things coming through the ELCA. One was with the Episcopalians, and one was with the Reformed.
It was the late 90s, it was 96 and 97, I think.
Yeah. And the Reformed one went through with almost no problems.
Breezed
right through. Because it didn't require anything to change in the daily life of the church. Lutherans just got to say, we accept the Reformed as churches, as real Christians. But the Episcopalian one asked Lutherans to change how they did ordination. And you all know the story, probably, about Word Alone and the whole kerfuffle that enveloped and, in some sense, contributed to the ongoing difficulties in the ELCA now that bubbled up further around sexuality issues in the 2000s, right? It's really hard when we get into structures. Because, as I was saying here during the break, there's a book by a Jesuit whose name I'm blanking on right now that's called The Mighty from Their Thrones. It's a theology of the Old Testament in which he talks about how changes in theology lead to changes in who wields power for what. We talked a little bit about that the other day with Marduk and how leading to monotheism divorces, in some sense, the king from God, right? Okay, so that's a nice, easy transition to politics. So let's jump right in. Politics in the United States is, shall we say, at the moment, fraught. I don't think this is news to any of you. We are at a point where, in our politics, where Democrats and Republicans have trouble recognizing in the other a authentic Americanism, an authentic patriotism. And this is, what we're going to do for the next few minutes is a very simple diagnosis of one potential difference between Democrats and Republicans, right? This is not the magic key that will solve all the problems, but it is an example of the ways that differing metaphorical structures lead to very different and not understandable decisions being made by other people. So George Lakoff is a guy we've talked about a number of times. He's one of the early cognitive linguists. He comes from the linguistic side of things. He's one of the first sort of cognitive linguist thinkers about metaphor. And in the mid-90s, he writes a book about American politics, where they were still pretty contentious. Remember the mid-90s, that's after Newt Gingrich and before the Clinton impeachment and all that stuff, right? And he starts going around and talking to people about how they view the country. Because when we think about politics, on some level, our basic question is always, what is best for the country? Right? And what he started noticing was that many people in the United States think about the country in terms of family metaphor. We talk about our founding fathers. In times of war, we talk about sending off our sons and daughters. Mm-hmm. We think about the country in some sense as a family. And so then he started pushing farther in terms of how do people describe their families? What makes a good family? What leads to self-disciplined, self-reliant adult children? And when he asked those questions, he found strong correlations between more conservative thinkers thinking about families in terms of a strict father model and more progressive liberal thinkers thinking about families in terms of a nurturant parent model. So in one model of family, the way that you love your children is to provide them strict boundaries, clear authority, and the rules of goodness so that they have all of that internalized by the time they turn 18 and they're off on their own. In another model, the role of parents is to care about and care for children and give them space so that they can develop a sense of the world that leads to self-discipline and self-reliance. so that when they do go off on their own, they've internalized things that they have discovered themselves rather than things that are imposed from without, right? And he sees in this, in one model, there is more of an emphasis on obedience. In another model, there is more of an emphasis on discovery. Punishment is dealt with very differently in these two models, right? If you think about families, you know, who fit one model or the other, there's a very different thing between putting your child in a timeout and having a conversation with your child about what's going on in the situation, right? I was having a conversation about this earlier today with somebody who said, those are really interesting titles, and there's a inherent bias in them against the strict father model. Hmm. And the more I thought about that over the course of the morning, I think that that's true here, because we're at Holden Village, which is in a sense a bastion of the nurturing parent model. But I don't think that if you're talking to people who really adhere to the strict parent model, I don't think they would see it as dismissive. I'm thinking of some parents I know who are very much in this model, and they think the best thing they can do for their children is to be strict with them. And if you say the strict father, and specifically have a strict father. And so one of the things that's changed since the 90s is perhaps that even people who are more politically conservative have moved towards a more nurturing parent model with their own kids, right? In such a way that the strict father model does have some of those negative connotations. But Lakoff is arguing then, in the 90s, that these models lead towards all kinds of different decisions about how we should structure our politics. If we think of the country as a family and the role of the government as being the strict father, then its role is to impose obedience to morality, to including all kinds of market morality, right? The government has to balance its checkbook, just like anybody else. It's a common thing you'll hear from, which is a...
Well, nobody thinks that anymore. No, I mean, that's not a conservative philosophy anymore.
Well, it's a thing you will hear people say. Not necessarily conservative government, people in politics. We're not talking about actual politicians here. Because
about parties, we're talking about philosophical positions.
Personal.
Parties have drifted from their...
Yeah, my good old boy golf course, all the conservatives are angry about Trump's spending.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good to hear at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I get your point, Matt.
He doesn't represent the conservative. The
because once we get power into the mix of a lot of these things, there will be people in any party who will say things to get power that they don't actually believe in. Right? But if we're thinking about how people vote, right, how people engage with politics, and then how those politicians form their message in order to loop people in, we've got this, right? The government... Any good family has to balance its checkbook. The government has to run a balanced book, right?
Apparently not.
No, but you see, like that's the art. Like we're not judging the metaphor at this point, right? We are understanding the metaphor.
Yeah.
And if you're living in that model, then a whole set of arguments will make sense to you that won't make sense to you if you think that the government's role is to provide a situation in which people can grow into fuller human beings through self-discovery and self-knowledge. You see what I'm saying? And the way that you were raised, the way that you think about how you were raised, the way you chose to raise your own children, where you live, these metaphors are built out of experiences. Let me just think with you for a minute about last night. Everyone was at Vespers last night? What did we do at Vespers last night? At the end. We sang together. What did we sing together?
One heart at a time will change the world.
Yeah, the one thing we need, the one thing that everyone needs yeah. is to have our hearts here together, right? That is a structural formation of what goodness looks like and how change happens in the world. That repetitive singing together strengthened and built metaphoric ways of thinking, for Holdenites. I'm not saying it's wrong, right? We can't think in other ways. But that is a way of thinking that strengthens particular, that's going to lead you towards reacting in particular ways in the future. That's why one of the reasons we do liturgy, right? When we say liturgy is formative, this is what we mean. Let me take a slightly less, well, maybe not, slightly less contentious issue. Think about the ways that people in your church, if you're at a church that has a traditional and a contemporary worship style, think about the ways that people talk about what worship is for. Everybody agrees that worship is formative, right? But what are we forming people into at those two places? Do you see the kinds of things I'm talking about here? So we have 10 minutes left, and this is how I'd like to use them. I'd like to give you each 2 of those minutes to think through your own lives, your own, the communities that you belong to, the places that you care about. Because if we don't care about our relationships with other people, none of this matters, right? The reason that ecumenism is interesting for this is that people care deeply about unity, and also they care deeply about the difference. Where are the relationships that you care about? And maybe it's politics, maybe it's the contemporary service at your church versus the traditional one, maybe it's bigger Lutheran church politics, maybe it's something with a sister or a brother in your family. Where are the questions where you keep finding yourselves running into a wall and saying, this just doesn't make any sense? I'm going to give you 2 minutes to think about that on your own. And then I'm going to give you the option to have a conversation about that with somebody else in the room. I recognize that a lot of these things are personal. You may not want to. Don't feel like you have to share. But as we get into those conversations, I'd like you to begin to think about what would be the question that I could ask that might help me understand where I could stand to see the metaphor that makes this a reasonable place to stand. Even if you end up saying, I reject this position. But remember what I said, one of the rules from the ecumenical dialogue is, until you can speak back to somebody what they mean in a way they recognize, you can't reject it. You can't judge it.
So we're thinking of like somebody, a position that somebody holds that doesn't make sense to us.
Ideally somebody that you know.
Right, right.
Not,
but that's
you know.
If you were in a discussion, you'd be thinking, how could you think that like that? Okay.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to give you 2 to 3 minutes on your own, and then I'm going to invite you to either have a conversation with somebody else or continue thinking on your own at that point.
This is from Wednesday. There was a book you mentioned, I just want to get the title, what people are thinking, it's been endless to me, by a man.
Lenny Duncan.
Pastor.
It's called Dear Church.
Thank you. Okay. It wasn't, I didn't see it here, so.
No, it's checked out of the library.
Here you go.
I'll put it back later today.
I'll get a copy of help. I'm taking it off tomorrow, but yeah, this
Lenny
is it.
Duncan.
Right?
Let me write it down. I'll order a copy. Thanks.
Because they recognize this one so far over there.
Sure. And realize that the millennials are here.
So in that model, what's the most common place where that comes to a head? Like, where's the actual conflict?
Who gets promoted is an issue. And what kind of people get promoted? How problems, does anybody care about problems that occur inside the organization or conflict from outside? And budgeting. What do we do? What do we do with all the money for it? What seems to be important?
Okay.
Those are the three main in my experience.
Great. In corporate. Yeah. So when you're thinking about this, I invite you to think about what are the questions that might help people to have a real conversation about things that they're actually disagreeing about instead of what's their outcome.
A small enough group that people could just kind of that we could talk
together. I would be okay with that.
Throw out
I don't want
the things.
I'm okay with it. I'm taking it in a different direction.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm hoping this will lead to conversations throughout the day, right? And I'm going So would anybody like to share with us sort of a sticking point that they've been thinking about?
Go ahead. I had a really hard time coming up with one because I've had discussions and arguments with people about certain things, but I finally came up with one that's always driven me crazy, where people say that affirmative action is racism against white people. So that was the one that I came up with that I still get exasperated.
Okay, so what do you think the underlying disagreement is? What's the metaphoric structure that leads to that being a... Does anyone have a sense of that?
Well, I mean, I've talked to folks who said that as well, and I mean, maybe not enough folks. I would like to talk to more folks, but this few conversations that I've had is about inequality. I feel like it's like a reversal of inequities. From my best understanding, conversation that I have, they're saying, well, you know, it's unfair to white people. Because there's an unfair advantage to people of color. So what I heard the person saying is they didn't feel good about the inequity, what they experienced as an inequity.
Sure, I think that's probably where this conversation might need to go, right, is what is equality?
Yeah.
Well, right, so again, I'm not saying this is my position, right?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I turned off the microphone was part of the conversation, right? But I can imagine someone saying, if you approach with a question of saying, if you assume sort of the things we say about our country are true, all people are treated equal, everyone has an equal shot, anyone can be president, then you're starting to think about individual equity.
Mm-hmm.
And so one difference between progressives and conservatives on affirmative action is progressives are more willing to think about class, cultural, racial distinctions that aren't just about sort of individual shots, right? So if someone says affirmative action kept my kid out of college, the good that they're trying to protect is an individual equality. Now they're not seeing how that individual equality is already not equal, right?
Yeah,
but. Until that conversation can happen,
Don't you have to even just start by, what happens though when people don't believe that the metaphor is false? Like, I think a lot of people, you know, last night talking about privilege, so the metaphor to me here is that we live in a country where there's equal opportunity, which of course has never been true and is a bit, you know.
And probably can't be true, let's admit that.
Right, right, but I think a lot of people wouldn't, I think people really believe that stuff.
Well, I think that if you define racism, as many people do, as, you know, power to do something, power and prejudice, or, you know, power where you make a, where you do something against someone that hurts them in some way because of their skin color. If you make that the definition, then it's true that, in a sense, white people are getting hurt in some way because of their skin color. But beyond that, I think you can say, if you look at the broader picture, that in those cases, it is appropriate racism because of the bigger picture in which we have all this systemic years of history. Okay. And so in that
sure.
sense, if you want to define racism that way, go ahead and agree with them. Yes, it's racism, but if you look at the bigger context, it is appropriate
okay.
to make that decision
great.
Anyway.
I just want to point out you've shifted to four.
What was four?
You jumped from two to four.
Responsible. Yeah.
Responsible. What should we do about this? And I'm asking us to stay with two for a minute.
Okay.
What does
two
it mean?
Was
intelligent. What does it mean?
I see.
What is it? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. Is it true? What should I do about it? And the problem is, especially in a group like this, where I imagine most of us probably agree on the question you bring up, it's very easy for us to say, well, this is wrong, let's move on.
Uh-huh.
Right? This is partly why ecumenical dialogue can't be done unless there's people speaking on it on behalf of the things they care about in the room. Right? You have to have Lutherans and Catholics in the room to do ecumenical. I can't do ecumenical dialogue on my own. Right? And so it's a hard exercise to do here, right? Because we need somebody who's actually espoused that position.
So what would I have said? Like, give me
so
your idea.
So my question, in that point, I would say, when I've been in those conversations, I find myself running up against people for whom equality is about individual access. And so if equality is about individual access in a way that collapses all sort of previous things that have a previous kind of access, right? The kinds of myths you're talking about equal opportunity. Then I can see, if that were true, how this could lead to this position. Mm-hmm. And so in that conversation, I might do some thinking, and this is where we move to three, right? Is it true? Uh-huh. And in that conversation, I might just try and do some thinking about how I could have a conversation with somebody that recognized the true things that they're saying. And you're doing this mm-hmm. at the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing. And say, okay, is that actually the world we're living in? And part of the problem is that the world we're living in, as you can tell us from your work with cross-cultural engagement.
Two different worlds sometimes.
Sometimes it's, were you guys here for...
Experiences.
You're right. And so
yeah.
getting, even saying to somebody, that's not the world we're living in. What does that do in those kind of, in your experience?
It depends on where they are on their intercultural competence.
Sure.
Because it can further polarize their perspective if they're in that orientation of polarization, or they might minimize another's cultural experience.
So can I,
yeah. So it kind of really depends on their experience. It could cause a number of responses.
Right, so in some ways, it's easier for a progressive person to say, and even just listen to this language, I can say, I participate in structures of racism. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
For a conservative person in our country to say that, they would probably be hearing, I am an awful person and a racist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to make a distinction between equality and equity? Because
yeah.
to me, equality
yeah,
is everybody gets the same exact ladder, but equity is the shorter person gets the taller ladder.
Sure, yeah.
That's really, yeah, that's great, because what I wanted to bring up, I'm going to talk about college applications, so you can say not everybody who's applying to college has been provided the same ladder, you know, because if I live in a wealthy neighborhood, regardless of the ethnic composition of it, versus a poor neighborhood, by default, I'm have an advantage to that application. And so if the school is trying to provide some opportunity to economically disadvantaged students,
that could appear as reverse racism, but there's an equity to that that is a value to those students.
Sure. And let me go one step further back on that. That presumes an expectation that equity is, in fact, the thing that we should be going for.
It's a value, it's a value that supersedes the individual perspective.
Which requires a kind of death to self. Right?
There's a cost to it.
There's a cost to it, right? And I think most of us in this room would say that's a cost that we should be paying. But I know a lot of folks who would say, how can I ask my children to pay this cost? Right? So when people say my kids should have gotten into college, what they're really saying is, why should my child pay this cost?
Especially if they come from, there are lots of white people who come from really poor backgrounds, and they're like, hey, I grew up poor with really hard times too, you know? I mean, that's their...
Same thing is true with gun control. You know, when I die, come and pry this gun out of my dead hand, you know, kind of thing. I'm going to preserve my independent right versus the good of the whole world.
And guns mean different things in rural and urban contexts in the United States, right? Guns mean different things, and these are not the same categories, right? Rural and urban and white and black, but they mean different things in different places in our country. And so where you fit into all of those overlapping things is gonna matter. Where you fit into progressive and liberal things, where you fit, how you, whether or not you think the first clause of the Second Amendment matters, right? All of that stuff interacts to produce a whole sort of variegation of responses to these things.
I heard it said that, really distilling it simply, a conservative mindset is to protect the group, and a more liberal mindset is to protect the outlier. And I don't know what I'm getting at or if that's helpful, but to me, it helped me give some context that instead of villainizing one or the other, to say, like, oh, okay, this is maybe what each person is going, this maybe is an aim. To protect the group, I understand that feeling. Seek to protect the person on the margins. I understand that that's a value point as well, and where some of that conflict might come from.
And who's the group is, in some sense, been the question in the 21st century. Now, I wish we could solve these questions today. It is noon, and I want to let you guys get some lunch. If you take one thing away from today, I hope it's this. Generally speaking, people are not stupid, right? If people have come to positions that they are deeply committed to, they have reasons for them. They might be wrong, but if you can understand why it makes sense to that person, you are more likely to convince them in the end that whatever you're trying to convince them. Right? Dialogue starts with understanding. Yeah.
One way that's been really helpful for me, I can't remember who first told me this, but it's like everybody's valid, but not necessarily right.
Yeah.
So like, I try to lead with that. It's like, I try to validate everyone's experience and opinion. I mean, I agree with it, but it's still valid because it's about the experience.
Except how do you get people to really say why they think what they think?
Conversation, relationship,
create a safe space.
It took 50 years and ongoing interpersonal relationships between Lutherans and Catholics to get to the heart of justification, right? Because they had to start learning to trust each other enough to actually have the conversation. So if progressives in this country actually want to change the dialogue around, I mean, Harvey Milk's not wrong, right? Coming out changed the dialogue around gay people in this country in a completely different way. Because suddenly people say, this is my daughter you're talking about. This is my nephew you're talking about. This is my whoever. And the fact, ecumenism cannot happen without love. And in fact, learning to care about the other person allows there to be space for their views, whatever the thing is, right? And it's one of the dangers of contemporary American politics is that we're segregating ourselves everywhere from marriage to everything else.
There's no relationship anymore.
Yeah, in a different Pew poll last year, people were saying they would rather that their children, for the first time, people said people would more prefer that their children marry someone of a different race than someone of a different political persuasion.
Isn't that amazing?
Which is, I mean, great for either, but like, can you imagine that someone saying that in 1986, for example, right?
Okay, it all goes back to what you and Glenn have, the fundamental documents under which we're dealing with. You have the strict conservative, you have the strict constructionist in the Constitution, and you have the literalist. You know, there's this fundamental hermeneutical position.
Sure, and he fought it about the Bible a number of years before that.
That's happening in both these worlds. Mm-hmm. Labor management, I'm in this all the time. Two different everything.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, we are. Thanks.